wasn't sure which movie to use today, so we just used all of them. I've got a 15-year-old daughter, and when she was about 10, she started being interested in these dystopian novels, and so my wife said, well, we should kind of read them and see if they're, you know, okay, or if they're too adult for her at that age. And so I said, well, I think I could do that. I read pretty fast, and I don't mind. And so I started reading young adult dystopian novels, and now my Kindle thinks I'm a 13-year-old girl because I've read all of them and seen all of the movies, and it's not a sacrifice. It's no longer me being a good dad. It's just pretty sweet. But I don't know. It's funny, like every one of these movies, I was discussing it with her this week, like they all have the same plot and they all sort of have the same characters, and it's all sort of this happily never after idea. It's sort of the opposite of they lived happily ever after. And I'm not sure why they are so popular, though. I'm not sure why this genre, which might be tapering off, I'm not sure. And as we talked about last week, I don't think that we necessarily just get our vision of the future from movies. I think maybe movies get their vision of the future somehow from culture, because we're the ones buying the tickets. And you have to admit, there are a lot of these movies. Some have been more successful than others. And maybe it's because of the architecture. You know, there's something, I don't know, I think maybe as Americans, we just like seeing a good bombed out city every once in a while. They always have that drone fly over and the city's in ruins and there's still some smoke coming up, and they all look sort of the same. It's all sort of looks like Detroit. I don't know. Maybe that's why. I don't know. But or maybe it's not the architecture. Maybe it's not the post-apocalyptic, you know, buildings. Maybe it's the future healthcare. That looks sweet, right? Like where most of the people have died and everyone else is sort of just groaning on a cot, which is like, why do we watch that? I don't know. I've noticed that in everyone. They're like, there's always sick people, zombies, there's something like that where like most of the people are dead, but there are a few people left. And then these other ones are really, really sick and we seem to not be doing a lot for them. So that's sort of, and speaking of healthcare, I've noticed this too. I was talking to my daughter about that this week. Apparently in the future, according to dystopian movies, you can only get a shot in the neck, because every one of these, I think it's because it's the most cringeworthy shot you can get. Like if you fear needles, every one of these, like, oh, if you've got to get your, you know, your shot, it has to be like a giant hypodermic gun and you just stick it through your neck. It's so gross. But that seems to be the only, maybe that's why these movies are popular. We just want to see people get enormous needles in the neck. But at least you can look forward to, in the future, according to dystopian movies, really oppressive government, right? Like even worse than now, believe it or not. Like it's crazy. Like every one of these movies sort of have the same government. They've got, and the cops all wear motorcycle helmets all the time, you know? It's, for some reason, they're all in white like stormtroopers. We'll talk about Star Wars later. But I don't know where that came from, but every one of these movies sort of, and they call them peacekeepers or something innocuous like that, but they're super oppressive and it's, maybe that's it. It's weird to think about, like, why do we love these movies when it's such a bleak, bleak picture of the future, and that always includes government surveillance. It's always like the government is watching you. Since the movie 1984, since the book 1984, it's always been Big Brother is watching you. That's always a part of these movies. Or maybe it's that moment in every dystopian movie, the uprising, right? Like every one of these movies at the end, when the hero finally comes forward and the people rise up and they're slaughtered immediately, but we somehow are like, yeah, go people. I don't want to be there. I don't want to rush rush the gates of the Capitol. I don't want to rush the palace, but good for you. You kind of want to be behind that crowd, I've noticed. Like the first people always get mowed down and you're like, sucks to be in the front row. But every one of these movies, like there's that moment when all the people finally have had enough and they rush the palace, or they rush the compound, or they rush the gate. Or maybe we're looking for a hero who happens to be a teenage girl. I don't know why. Most every time it's... And having a teenage daughter, I think if anybody's going to do it, they're the toughest creatures we have on the planet, so I can kind of buy into that. I got a 15-year-old, and yeah, I think if anybody can, but for some reason, all of these movies, we're looking for a hero, and just happens to be a teenage girl involved in some sort of love triangle, which is a big part of the movie as well, if you have never noticed in all of them. I don't know what it is. I don't know why these movies are so popular, but they are, and I'll admit, I like them, and maybe it's definitely not the hygiene or the food. If you notice one thing about the future, if you watch these movies, the food looks horrible. Like, buy me a hamburger, please. It's some sort of weird mush or some sort of energy bar, and no one is showered in the future. That seems to be completely gone, but I don't know why they're so popular, but I know they are popular, and here's why. Raph reminded me of this last week, and I want to show you something that just proves that at least in the past few years, this genre has become so crazy popular, because I want you to watch this short dystopian film. I'm so hungry for tacos. That was an actual Taco Bell commercial, and it might be better than every dystopian movie together. But isn't it strange that these movies all sort of take the same path and we sort of go to them, and at least our kids and one 50-year-old guy are reading the books because, oh my goodness, they're selling. But I really didn't want to bring you here today and just talk Hunger Games, although I am qualified. I know my Hunger Games. Team PETA. But it's really not what I wanted to talk to you about this morning. What I wanted to talk to you about is this idea that we've talked about with different movies from the future of, we've said it before, we've said, and I would say this about the Hunger Games, it's not a trilogy, there's four of them now, but the movie was good, but I thought the book was better. Well, I want to tell you this morning that every movie about the future, I think the book, the Bible, has a better future than you can even imagine from those movies. Now, I understand this morning, and I'll fully admit this, it is weird to come out on a Sunday morning and talk about prophecy, to talk about Revelation, the book of Revelation, and we're going to talk about the book of Daniel and Ezekiel later on in this series, and I realize that is weird. And I fully realize it because this week I was like, I need to sort of read through all of those, and I didn't really have time to read through, so I was listening to the guy on the Bible app read all of those prophecies all week multiple times, and I was like, man, nothing like going through your work day hearing the book of Revelation. I don't know, in a really cool English accent. So I fully admit and I fully understand this morning that it's weird to talk about Revelation, which is probably why we're 10 years into being a church and I've never done a series like this. But what struck me a few months ago as I was thinking about this, it's weirder that as Christians, we know all we know about the future, or all our vision from the future, comes from movies and not from the Bible. It would be stranger, even though this is going to be weird, and even though it's kind of like, oh, why do you do that? I think it would be stranger if we go, hey, we are Christians, and if you're not a Christian here this morning, I'm so glad you're here. You're welcome. We're a place that we love for you to come and question and be skeptical if you wish, but at least you kind of know, like, this is how weird Christians are, and you can take that away with you with a donut. And I really, really, if you're not a Christian, I appreciate how open-minded you are to even listen to me this morning. But if you are a Christian, if you go, Christ is King, Jesus is Lord, and he's in charge, and I believe what he said, then it would be weird if we didn't know anything about what the Bible said about the future. We only sort of got our ideas about the future from Hunger Games or Maze Runner or any number of other futuristic sci-fi films. And so now I will also admit another thing is that Revelation, the book of Revelation, is really weird. In fact, I had a conversation with someone this week and they made a good point. They go, Don, I hear you're talking about the book of Revelation, but do you understand it? And I said, no, I do not. You know, and this picture here, this is actually taken from Revelation 13:1. This is just an artist's representation of Revelation 13:1. Let me read it to you. It says, then I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, and it had 7 heads and 10 horns. And if you're going, well, that's a weird passage. Oh, there's lots of multiple-headed creatures in the book of Revelation. And 10 crowns on its horns. And written on each head were names that blaspheme God. I don't think the artist managed to get that in there. But this is an actual representation. If you just took Revelation and go, this is what it says, and I'm going to tell you what it says, that is a pretty good picture of Revelation 13:1. So Do I know what the ten heads? I've read books, but nothing that I could come today and go, hey, I know what the ten heads stand for. I know what the horns say. I even know the names that are written on the forehead. I'll tell you, and then you'll know too. That is not what we're here to do this morning. But what I told this person, and I think they made a good point, like, well, how can you talk about a book if you don't understand it? And what I said to them, and I realized, like, I need to say the same thing to you. I don't understand women. I mean, you knew that, right, already? I have a wife. I have a daughter. My brother visited from Missouri this morning, and he has four daughters. So I literally had a house full of girls this week of all ages. And I'll tell you something. I like it. Like, I'm much more comfortable with that than if my sister would have came with all her boys. Because her boys would be like, let's go fishing. Let's throw the football around. Let's watch some. I was like, not interested. But the girls I get along with, because they're like, let's go shopping. Let's get ice cream. Let's watch a movie. I'm like, I am down with that. So I'm comfortable with them, but I don't understand them. Now, I could spend the rest of the morning telling you stuff I don't understand about women, but I'll just give you one for instance. I don't know what my wife and daughter do after they start the car for 4 minutes. I was following them the other night. We both went to the same place. We both left at the same time, and I noticed they do this every time they get in the car. They start up the car. And there's movement inside, I can see, but nothing happens. Like, when a guy, or at least when I get in the car, I don't put on a seatbelt, I don't even close the door, I don't set the radio, I just start backing up. I'll back over you if you're I backed over my neighbor, that's another story. But like, I don't do anything, I just put it in reverse and go. But like, I'm sitting there, and I was like, waiting, and right when I was opening my door to go, is the transmission out, they just took off. But I notice they do that all the time. I think there's like lotioning going on. There's like, seriously, I know there is, because there's lotion in every car they drive. So there's lotioning, there's like radio setting, I don't know, pillow fights. I don't know what happens. But I know this, I shouldn't ignore what they say just because I don't understand that, right? Is that fair? Like, there's a lot of things I don't understand that they do. There's a lot of things that I don't understand that they say, but I shouldn't ignore what they say. And there are parts that I get pretty clearly. It's got finger motion. No, it doesn't. Like, but I understand some things women say to me, so I don't ignore them. And I think that's the way we should look at the book of Revelation. Like, I don't understand everything in it. I think some parts, my guess is, and I don't think the guys who say they understand it totally. Talking to my dad this week, and it was interesting because he's 80-some years old, and he's preached it and studied it and written about it, and he's like, I just found this out the other day, or I think I was wrong about it. And I'm like, yeah, I think that's the way it is. In fact, my guess is the way it was written with the apocalyptic writing, I think maybe some of the stuff we're just going to get to the end and go, oh, I don't think you're even going to know until you look backwards what, you know, the John the Revelator was trying to describe to us, is my guess. But I think there are some very, very, very clear themes in Revelation. That's what I want to talk to you about this morning. If we're looking at this idea of, like, we have all these dystopian movies, and they're all the same. They're all like, the government is oppressive, things are bleak, there's been some sort of mass casualty event, whether it was a war or a disease, and a new government arises, and at that point they go, hey, we're going to solve crime, we're going to save you from this war, we're going to save you from this disease, and then they turn out to be super oppressive and oppress the people more than ever, and finally one teenage girl with a crossbow stands up and goes, I'm not going to take it anymore, and it's awesome, and then she has two boyfriends, and that part we read for a while, and then finally, the people rise up, and the people rise up, and they take down the oppressive government, and then it's always like right as you start to feel good and the music swells, they kind of go, but the new government is worse than the last one. You're like, oh, no, you know, that is a story from dystopian fiction. So I just want to tell you some clear themes from Revelation. Now, in the book of Revelation, in the book, cities are destroyed, just like in every, you know, that architecture that you see in every dystopian film. I think in the book of Revelation, you see a lot of that. It says, then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, and the angel had great power, and the angel's glory made the earth bright. And the angel shouted with a powerful voice, she is destroyed, the great city of Babylon destroyed. And this entire chapter goes on. Now, I'm not saying this is what it is, but I'm saying, like, if you read that chapter and you thought of a nuclear blast, the great blast of light, and let me give you another example. It says, "Oh, Babylon, the music of people playing harps and other instruments, flutes and trumpets will never be heard. No worker doing any job will ever be found in you again. The sound of a millstone will never be heard in you again. The light of a lamp." You get this picture from Revelation at various points, like, whether or not it's a nuclear bomb, I have no idea. But I will say this, it is a perfect picture of what would happen in the event of that sort of catastrophic bombing or something like that, because there's a bright light, there's intense melting heat, and then it says the land is, it's not just destroyed, it's uninhabitable forever. So that's in the book. If you wanted to know, that's in the book, and it's in there numerous times. Here's another thing that's in the book. Over 50, in the book of Revelation, not counting violence, not counting even the wars, over 50% of the people on the planet in the book of Revelation die. And I'll tell you how, I'm not great at math, but I'm pretty sure about that. It says in Revelation 6, notice this, it says, when he opened the fourth seal, and once again, you have all these figurative languages. We have seals, and we have bowls, and we have trumpets, and we have, you know, like, I don't know, the great big box of pain that we're going to pour out. I mean, I just made that part up. But there's all these sort of figurative and hard to understand parts. But I think you can't just ignore the whole thing that what it, the picture it paints, the very, very, very clear picture it paints, is that most people die during this time period. Because it says this, it says, when he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature say, "Come." And I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and its rider's name was Death, and Hades, or hell, followed him. And they were given authority over a fourth of the earth to kill with the sword, and with famine, and with pestilence, and by the wild beasts of the earth. Bear attacks? I mean, this is frightening. But 50% of the people die. Now, you go, well, that's a quarter of the people. Yeah, I get that. That's a 25%. Let's write 25% off from that verse. If we do a little math here, a little later, three chapters later, it says, and this is afterwards, it says, by these three plagues, and this is a third of mankind was killed by the fire and the smoke and the sulfur coming out of their mouths. This is from the witnesses, from the prophets. So what we have here is 25% of the people die in chapter 6, not counting violence and natural death, and later on where it says people will literally try to die and can't. It's such a bad situation, not counting hunger later on. So we have 75% left, and it says a third of them die, so we're down, if you do the math, 75% people left. A third of that is 25% of the original number. Now we're down to 50%, and that's in three chapters, not counting. So it's a very, very, very bleak picture, and I think we can go, okay, I don't understand all the bowls and the trumpets, but it sounds like, at least, it's starting to sound like Hunger Games, pretty clear. Now, another thing you notice that is like, if you want to go, is the future in Revelation a dystopian film? Well, the environment is wrecked in this book. Here's an example. It says, the first angel blew his trumpet, and there followed hail and fire, which I was just realizing, like, I've been preaching a long time. I've never read this verse. Never came up, but man, we'll read it this morning. Mixed with blood, and there was thrown upon the earth, and a third of the earth was burned up, and a third of the trees were burned up. I mean, talk about, you see the wildfires in California, how horrible, horrible they are when you imagine, like, hundreds of acres or thousands of acres, or even in some case, we've seen wildfires of millions of acres. That's nothing like this. We're talking about a third of all the earth and all the trees on fire. Here's another one. The sea became like blood. And that's one of those that's weird too, because over time, excuse me, you read that and you go, well, that's figurative, it's blood, but that actually happens. Not the sea turns into blood, but there are whole areas of the sea that we have found, of the oceans, they turn red and all the stuff dies in them. And this happens, like they run across this area that's just turned red and died, and all the living creatures then have died. This is a thing. And it says, hey, if you want to look forward to this part, everything living thing died in all the sea. So all of the sea, this happens. This is such an upper today. Aren't you glad you came this morning? But this is the story of Revelation. And my point this morning is not just, oh, you should be scared. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. But if you want to know, if you've ever watched a dystopian film and go, though that's fiction, There are parts of it that look and sound very much like the book of Revelation. Here says, something flew from the sky and fell on one third of the rivers and the springs of water, and the waters became poisonous and unable to drink, and many people died from that. Darkness is a thing when it comes to Revelation. Don't know how that works, but it says the stars are blocked. And I'm not even sure in this whether the stars are actually gone, or it could be like the smoke of all this makes it where it's dark most of the day. I mean, that's a thing that could happen. And when you're not worried about the environment crashing around you and over 50% of the people dying, don't worry, there's something to do, because again and again and again in this book, war is everywhere. And it says that another horse appeared, a red one, and the rider was giving a mighty sword and the authority to take peace from the earth. And there was war and slaughter everywhere. So this idea of a 50% mass casualty that we find early in the book probably becomes much larger over time as the wars rage on. And if you're wondering, you know, one staple of every dystopian book is this oppressive government. This government that's controlling, and this government that is harming people, and this government that is just pounding people. And that's included in the book of Revelation. Here's something. This is one of the few verses you might have heard these about. It says in the beast, because this shows up in popular culture as well, because it's sort of a famous concept. And it says, then the beast was allowed to wage war against God's holy people and to conquer them. And he was given authority. This is the part where they destroy the nation of the, or try to destroy the nation of Israel again. And he was given authority to rule over every tribe and every people and every language and every nation. And all the people belonged to this world worshiped the beast. They're the ones whose name were not written in the book of life that belongs to the Lamb who was slaughtered before the world was made. And it says that he required everyone, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to be given a mark on the right hand or the forehead. And no one could buy or sell anything without that mark, which was either the name of the beast or the number representing his name. And wisdom is needed here. Let the one who is understanding solve the meaning of the number of the beast, for the number is the man. His number is 666. So this gives a picture of not just an oppressive government, but like in most dystopian films, like it's a picture of a worldwide government. Now, interestingly enough, it even follows the path of all these dystopian films, where what leads up to this government in the book of Revelation and from other prophecies is that one guy steps up and says, I have the answer for your problems. I can bring you peace. And people go, well, things are so bad. There's so much war. I mean, you can sort of imagine that happening, right? Things are so horrible. Okay, we'll try it. And scripture says that for 3.5 years, things go great. Like, finally, there's peace. And then sort of, as in every good movie, sort of the cracks start to appear. And then he starts saying, hey, but we need to round these people up. I mean, we've seen this in history before. And if we could just get rid of the Jews, then that seems to be a common thread throughout history. And so that happens. And in the end, he says, you know what? If you don't worship me, and if you don't do what I say, you can't buy or sell. And it's funny, because in times past, we would kind of go, well, how could anyone stop you from buying and selling? All you have to do is buy and sell. We have cash. But we can sort of understand that now, right? Like, I don't know about you, but like, have you ever had my chip went out on my credit card and I never have cash? And I was like, I'm going to die. You know, I didn't know what to do, because it's like, in fact, let me tell you a little story about this grocery store over there. They were great to fix it, but when my chip went out, they kept going, try it again, try it again, try it again. And I bought $21 worth of merchandise and ended up using another card, but I got 21 charges of $21 on the next bill. It was like a steak and like a bag of buns cost us like $450. Now, they were great to take that off, but it gives you a picture like in the future, if we all sort of buy through some electronic means, someone could shut that down, right? Like everybody's like, oh, I got gold. I don't think that's going to work here. But here's the thing, like that's the picture. And once again, not trying to scare you, not going, hey, I understand how all this works and let me tell you who it is. No, none of that. But I just want to give you the big themes that I think are pretty clear, and they sound a lot like Hunger Games. There's technology. There's technology in this future world of Revelation. and possibly zombies. Let me read you this because this is pretty freaky. And this is sort of an idea that is not sort of a one-off weird that we don't understand. This idea is found throughout. It says that these witnesses, God sends witnesses back. God sends these prophets back to sort of protest what's going on, and they can't be killed. That's the weird thing. Like, for all this time, they can't be killed, and they prophesy, and they make everybody miserable. Everybody's like, shut up, will you stop? And not just that, they bring judgments down. Like, they say, oh, it's not going to rain, and it says they can actually bring fire down on people. So when people try to kill them, they bring fire down, they cause it not to rain. So people hate these witnesses. And finally, when the man of peace, when the Antichrist arises, another word I don't think I've ever said in a sermon here at Action Church, but hey, let's go for it. When the Antichrist arises, he says, you know what else I can do besides bringing peace to your world? I know how to kill those guys. And here's what happens. It says, now when they had finished their testimony, the beast that comes up from the abyss will attack them, and he will overpower them, and he kill them, and their bodies will lie in the public square of the great city, which is figuratively called Sodom and Egypt, which is also where the Lord was crucified. And for 3.5 days, some from every people, tribe, language, and nation will gaze on their bodies and refuse them burial. And the inhabitants of the earth will gloat over them, and they'll celebrate by sending each other's gifts, because these two prophets had tormented those who were on the earth. But after 3.5 days, the breath of the Lord God enters them, and they stood on their feet, and terror struck those who saw them. So there's a picture of everyone on the earth is celebrating that they're dead, and they're watching them, which in years past we go, how can that happen? And now you go, oh, selfie with the prophets. You know, so it's like, we can see that happening now, and I'm not saying it coming soon. I'm just saying now that is technologically possible. But imagine everybody watching them, and there's like a live feed of them just laying there, and all of a sudden they come back to life. So that's pretty scary. Earthquakes, asteroid strikes, I guess, talks about earthquakes that are greater. There's an earthquake in the book that says it's greater than any earthquake that's ever happened as long as the earth has been here. And we know from history and from the archaeological record, there's been some pretty big earthquakes. There's been continents that have been moved by earthquakes. And yet it says that there are greater earthquakes than that. And this idea of not just hail, but also there's other things of stone falling from the sky. Could be asteroid strikes. And if that is sounding pretty promising, and you're like, I'm excited about that future, at least you should know there's no food, so you'll starve. Which, once again, seems very Hunger Games-y. That's where they got the name. It says, I heard a voice from among the four living beings say, and do I know what the living beings are? No, they sound like aliens to me. And a loaf of wheat bread or 3 loaves of barley will cost a day's pay. And don't waste, and basically it says, and forget about olive oil and wine. You won't have any. So I know as you sit there, you're like, wow, this is the weirdest sermon ever, and wow, was that depressing, and isn't the name of this, but the book is better, because that does not sound better to me at all. In fact, that sounds terrifying, and I do not want to read the book of Revelation. And I get that. I thought that. I felt that as I'm reading it. And honestly, I could have done much more of this. Like, there's so many more. It's just terrifying. There's just terrible things happening every time you read another verse. You're like, oh, well, that sounds awful. Oh, that's worse than anything I've seen in a dystopian fantasy. But here's why I would say the book is better. And it's this verse that we started talking about last week, and it's a passage, it's a promise from Jesus. It's not a title. It's not like a job title. I am the Alpha and the Omega. I'm the beginning. It's a promise from Jesus that starts in the very first few words of Revelation and is written again in the end. And it's a promise. It says, I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end. The promise of Jesus in the book of Revelation is that just as I had a plan for the beginning of this world, I know how the story ends. And I'm not just waiting to see what happens. Like, there's a plan. And it's such a great promise for us as Christians, because all of us at certain times just go, it's falling apart. I mean, you turn on the news and you just go, it's shimmying apart. And it's funny, because we think, you know, it's the problem is we just don't live long enough. But if you go back, and as I do sometimes, I love history, and you kind of look at like what it must have been like for our grandparents as they went into, our great-grandparents now, who went into World War II, and the whole world is at war, and there's this guy who's taking, it seems like taking over the whole world, and there's camps just slaughtering people. You would have to think, oh, this is over. It can't get any, I mean, this world is shimmying apart, and that's happened so many times throughout history. But what this promise is no, it's not. No, it's not. Oh, I know things are bad, and in fact, I'm allowing it. We talked about last week that one of the promises of God is, hey, if you're going to be evil, I'm going to let you be evil. And if you're going, and it promises very little interference, actually, in the good, the bad, and the ugly of life. But I want to read you an ending that the book of Revelation gives. And it's an ending you won't find in any dystopian film. Because at the end of every good dystopian film, you get sort of this picture, the great picture in Hunger Games is that moment where she has a chance to kill President Snow, and she ends up killing the new leader instead. And that moment's like, oh my goodness, that's so, it's in every one of these that the new government is probably going to be worse than the last government. That even though they say they're going to save us from that government, guess what? They're going to take advantage of us too. And so that's sort of the picture of every dystopian story that's worth anything. I want to read you a different ending. And this is taken from Revelations 22:1-7. One through seven, sort of the last chapter of the Bible. It says, then an angel showed me a river, and he's walking around a city. Well, I don't even know if it's a city, because it's something that's 1,400 miles by 1,400 miles by 1,400 mile cube that comes out of the sky on a burned out earth and regenerates the entire earth. We're talking, I think we have to go Superman. I think we have to do Superman terraforming to get a picture of what that's like. But John is walking with an angel and seeing this vision of this 1,400 mile square cube that comes down out of the sky and sort of rebuilds the entire earth, this earth, the one we're on. And it says, then the angel showed me a river with the water of life, clear as crystal, flowing from the throne of God. So not only is the city setting here, it's got a river that emanates from the city and flows out into the land. And it flowed down the center of the main street, and on each side of the river grew a tree of life. So just as there was a tree of life in the beginning, Alpha and Omega, beginning and the end, just like there was a tree of life when the whole thing started, there's a new tree of life. And this tree bears 12 crops of fruit, a fresh crop each month. And the leaves are used for medicine and to heal the nations. So there are new nations outside of the city. And no longer will there be a curse on anything. Once again, the beginning and the end. In the beginning, there was a curse because we as humans ate from the wrong tree. We listened to Satan, and actually God said, no, if they eat from the tree of life, they'll live forever. So they have to be banished from this. But once again, now, the tree is back, and the medicine is back, and there's no curse anymore. That's all been taken away. And it says, for the throne of God and the Lamb will be there, and the servants will worship him, and they will see his face, and his name will be written on their foreheads, and there will be no night there. No need for lamps, no need for sun, for the Lord God will shine on them, and they will reign forever and ever. Then the angel said to me, everything you have heard and seen is trustworthy and true. The Lord God who inspires the prophets, tying together the entire scriptures, has sent his angel to tell his servants what will happen soon. And then Jesus says, look, I am coming soon. Blessed are those who obey the words of prophecy in this book. That's a better ending than any movie can imagine. An ending where it's not an uprising, it's not a revolution, it's not, oh, and then the people burn it down again, and then we bring up a new government, but eventually they will betray us and we'll burn it down. That cycle that's gone on forever, that's not this. It's an end, it's a beginning, it's a brand new world where no one dies. There is no curse, there is no sickness, it's an amazing thing that we can rest in. Now, I'm gonna have the band come up here, but I just wanna close with this. Because this can sort of be just information, right? Like, oh, Don told us what happened in Revelation. Oh, wow, that's weird. I'll not be reading that. And I get that. That's why we haven't talked a lot about it. But I think there's some practical things that we can take from this. Practically, as Christians, as followers of Christ, what that would say to me at least, and I think what you should take from it as well, is, man, we got to be very, very careful in putting our hope in man. And I don't care who you vote for. Go ahead and vote. Go ahead. And I'm not saying don't do that. I'm saying study and vote and be politically active, whatever. But anytime from history and from this story, anytime we put our hope in man to fix this, to stop war, to bring peace, to heal the environment, to make people like each other, to bring us utopia, it never turns out well. And that's the story of Revelation. Only God can and will do that. So we got to be very, very, very careful in putting our hope in man. And there's another part of this that practically we can rest. We can sort of take pleasure in knowing that, oh, as bad as things look, and it doesn't absolve me from doing my part as king of God's kingdom here on earth. It doesn't absolve me from caring about the environment. It doesn't absolve me from loving other people and serving them. But it does say that there's a happy ending. It isn't the happily never after of the dystopian fiction that we watch so much. And there's another thing that I cannot leave without telling you. The story says that very few people make it through this end process. And it's so easy, like in our world, to sort of go, well, you know, I'm a Christian, but my friends aren't, and my family aren't, and it really doesn't matter that much because they're fine too. They're good people. But what this should remind us is that the difference between this future, this beautiful future where we rule and reign forever with God, and whatever else the other thing is something that we should think about for every one of our friends and every one of our family members that we care about. Because this ending says that is the most important thing that you could care about, whether you have that relationship and that knowledge of God. So I want to pray with you. And I don't want to scare you and I don't want to bum you out. But I do think you should know this. And I do think all of our pictures shouldn't come from movies. And so next week, we're going to start talking about sort of the idea of what happens to our environment and what happens to people in the new heaven and new earth. And it's pretty exciting. Dear Lord, I'm so grateful for your picture of the future. It's better than any movie producer could come up with. It's better than any story writer. But God, I know as I read this that it's only for those who commit their hearts and their lives to you and make you Lord. So God, I pray as a church that we would care about that and not just care about that and feel bad about that, but we would actually make active steps to invite more people into this amazing, amazing future with you. In your name we pray, amen.